Chapter 19. The Silverman Mistake. John Coffin had his own theory. XMRV had been accidentally created in a lab at Case Western University in Cleveland between 1993 and 1996. Coffin described how lab workers there had transplanted human prostate tumor cells into an immune-deficient lab mouse, a common procedure for procuring a colony of cells, or a human cell line for further study. Hillary Johnson, Hunting the Shadow Virus, Discover, March 2013. When Joe DeRisi created his ViroChip in 2003 and claimed it could identify every known virus, the scientific community hailed it as a major breakthrough in viral detection, eventually awarding DeRisi the $250,000 Heinz Award for technological innovation in 2008. Scientific advance depends on the development of new technology. However, the tools often fall short of being able to evaluate complex natural or biological phenomena. DeRisi's ViroChip contained 72 base pairs of DNA from every known virus. The average replication-competent retrovirus contains approximately 8,000 base pairs of DNA. DNA viruses like EBV and HHV6 are much larger. Can a test, which contains less than 1% of the DNA of a virus, accurately identify a virus? The answer is, it depends. All scientists are taught that any procedure is only as good as the quality of materials used. This is why it was so stunning to learn in 2012 the prostate tissue Silverman used in the original study did not contain XMRV sequences, but that the RNA made from this tissue did contain XMRV sequences. 6 years later, they report an obvious source of contamination. Had they used appropriate controls, they likely would have detected their source of contamination in the beginning. While it's true that some viruses evolve and mutate quickly, it's also true that many regions of their DNA do not. When a conserved region of DNA is discovered, it provides scientists with an effective means of identifying the virus. However, this approach is fraught with the potential for error. The identification of a conserved region of DNA, one that does not change over millennia, could indicate the existence of a broader family of viruses. What about changes in the remaining DNA of the initial virus? When Bob Silverman and Joe DeRisi put the prostate cancer tissue samples on the ViroChip microarray, it lit up with what looked suspiciously like a mouse leukemia virus, MLV. There were a few base pairs of difference, but that was to be expected since the virus was found in human tissue. Since it was not exactly a mouse leukemia virus, they named it murine leukemia virus-related virus. And since it had been found in human tissue rather than mouse, they named it xenotropic, which means it was replicating in the cells of another species, namely human beings. That is how the virus came to be called XMRV, or xenotropic murine leukemia virus-related virus. All they had at this time was 72 base pairs out of an estimated 8,000 in a typical virus. If they wanted to make real progress, they had to get more genetic information about the virus, and the traditional way of getting this information was to extract and isolate the virus from an actual human, the same way that human retroviruses HTLV-1 and HIV-1 and almost all animal retroviruses had been discovered. By 2006, science had come a long way since Montagnier had isolated HIV, and some, like Lipkin and DeRisi, believed the shortcuts developed by the explosion of molecular technology to the well-known methods of viral isolation were valid and could be solely relied upon. Using a needle biopsy of three different prostate cancer tissue samples, Silverman and his collaborator at the Cleveland Clinic Jaydip Dasgupta, extracted a sample from VP62, one of the prostate cancer tissues. With the help of enzymes available in the laboratory, they took the 72 base pairs identified by the virochip, and just like one might see on a television pathology show, they used PCR, polymerase chain reaction, to amplify the genetic sample so that enough existed for appropriate testing. They call it genome walking, and the idea is to literally extend the 72 known base pairs out into other regions of the genome. This technique may produce errors because of low specificity and efficiency, short walking distance, and complexity of the methodology. But from this kind of clonal research all the way up to Dolly the sheep, all scientific cloning is a work in progress. Silverman and Dasgupta couldn't get enough of the 8,000 base pairs to create an actual infectious molecular clone. Mikovits would not learn until 2011 that they were not able to obtain enough genetic materials from the VP62 sample to create a clone. They would then go to other samples and start again. This yielded additional genetic sequences, but still not enough for their full-length molecular clone. They sequenced additional material from another sample to get their final sequences of the 8,000 base pairs in order to complete their infectious molecular clone. Then, with their sequences from three different patient samples, they attempted to piece together the sequence of what XMRV might look like in an actual human being. It was as if Silverman had created something of a Frankenstein virus from three different patients. What if there was significant variation between the viruses in these three patients? Or what if they had stitched the virus together incorrectly into a hastily made crazy quilt? They might not have duplicated what existed in nature, but created something entirely unique. For Mikovits and those of her generation who had been trained to isolate a virus from a single patient sample, this was, at best, work that needed to be carefully confirmed by an additional demonstration that this artificially created virus had a natural history of infection in humans or any species, something Silverman could not demonstrate. Without that step, his work remained incomplete. Since 2009, Mikovits had proposed that Silverman's infectious molecular clone could vary slightly from what actually existed in human beings, since all viruses evolve and change, and Silverman's crazy quilt was not a natural creation. She contended that this could cause problems with viral detection. Mikovits had argued that point in a roundtable discussion at the Invest in ME conference in May of 2010. Mikovits claimed that they had to use a natural isolate, or all bets are off as far as negative studies are concerned. Others disagreed and contended it made no difference. The timing, however, was a critical factor. If Silverman had revealed to Mikovits or Rossetti that the information that their infectious molecular clone had been created from three different samples rather than one, in 2009, rather than belatedly in the summer of 2011, Mikovits's team would have had additional ammunition for their concerns and likely would have prompted them to ask for additional controls. While the process of viral isolation from a single patient sample was much more time-consuming than what Silverman and Dasgupta had done, Mikovits would continue to believe it was the superior method. Mikovits couldn't help but view Silverman's 2-year delay in telling her this information as a sharp diversion from standard scientific protocol. The scientific community expects that a scientist will reveal both the strengths and flaws of their work so that other researchers, particularly collaborators, might accurately consider it. A scientist wasn't supposed to conceal the potential flaws of their work like some TV commercial pitchman. This failure would make it difficult for Mikovits to trust the work of Silverman and Dasgupta again. If they had revealed this information at the beginning of the investigation, the molecular clone could have served many useful purposes, such as being an analog for the virus until a complete sequence was generated from an actual human-derived isolate. And while Mikovits considered their infectious molecular clone to be just an approximation for the virus from the beginning, for the majority of the field, it was the only viral sequence they'd consider allegedly linked to ME/CFS or other diseases, until the publication of the Low and Alter paper in September 2010 that found variant mouse leukemia viruses, MLVs. Once Silverman and Dasgupta had engineered their full-length molecular clone in a plasmid construct, it was transfected into cells to generate large volumes of virus for study. To explain further, plasmids are best understood as molecular factories for generating viruses and cellular proteins. A plasmid is not a virus. A plasmid is a small, circular, double-stranded DNA molecule, which can be cut with certain enzymes, new DNA inserted, then reattached behind a promoter which turns on the production of the genes in the DNA. The plasmid is then inserted into cells through a process called transfection. Transfection involves altering the cell to open up pores in the cellular membrane so that the plasmids can enter into them. This is commonly performed using either electrical current or detergents. Once inside the right cells, such as LNCAP, the plasmid will churn out virus. A scientist working with plasmids needs to have a way to identify them, and luckily there are a few ways to make such identification. A plasmid can have certain genes inserted, like those for antibiotic resistance, or even the genes that make a jellyfish glow, which can then be used to mark those cells that contain the plasmid. In the case of jellyfish genes, through bioluminescence that actually illuminates the plasmid. Another way of identifying plasmid contamination is to look for the promoter sequences not contained in human cells. There was much evidence beyond the early electron micrograph that XMRV was a natural infection, and neither plasmid contamination nor contamination with 22RV1 lab contaminant had anything to do with the evidence of a related XMRV that Mikovits and her team isolated from the ME/CFS patient samples. First, Silverman had collaborated with a specialist in viral integration at the University of California, Los Angeles, to confirm that prostate tissue samples showed the retrovirus had integrated into human DNA. Second, there was a team from Emory University that had also shown the virus in human tissue, although they were only able to detect sequences of the virus, not the entire virus. Third, Ela Singh had detected viral proteins in prostate cancer tissue. All of these studies had been published between 2006 and the publication of their work in 2009. Whenever a question would arise regarding the sequence of the virus, Mikovits would contact Silverman to ask whether he was certain of the data. Silverman would remind her of the published literature he had generated at the Cleveland Clinic, the work done by the Emory team, and others. By early March of 2009, because of the difficulty in obtaining full-length sequences, Mikovits and Rossetti would raise the possibility the virus isolated from ME/CFS patients was not Silverman's XMRV. Silverman told them everything was done correctly in his lab at the Cleveland Clinic, and they believed him. After all, he had discovered XMRV. The envelope of XMRV Silverman was closely related to spleen focus-forming virus, SFFV envelope, the virus envelope upon which they had based their antibody test. The antibody test detecting reactivity to SFFV-ENV could not detect only antibodies to Silverman XMRV, but also to related virus envelopes. Mikovits was confident their test was detecting a related XMRV as they had validated it using appropriate competition studies. Plasmid contamination was another issue altogether, and Rossetti was astounded when Silverman first raised the plasmid contamination issue in a cryptic, roundabout manner with Frank Rossetti in June 4th through 8th, 2011, at the 15th International Conference on Human Retrovirology, HTLV, and Related Viruses in Leuven, Belgium. The conference was an opportunity to discuss recent data on the pathophysiology of human retroviruses with American as well as international researchers. One of the sessions was chaired by Robert Silverman and dealt exclusively with XMRV. As chair of the session, Silverman invited himself to give a talk on XMRV that he titled Human Infection or Lab Artifact. Will the real XMRV please stand up? His presentation left little doubt that as of June 2011, Silverman considered XMRV to be a human infection. Here is part of the abstract. Among the confounding factors are the potential for lab contamination with similar or identical viruses or viral sequences originating in mice. In some studies, relatively contamination-resistant methods, such as IHC, FISH, and antibody detection, suggest that either XMRV or a similar type of virus is present in some patients. Evidence for and against genuine infections of humans with this intriguing virus and/or related viruses will be discussed. Following Silverman was Shixing Lo, the collaborator with Harvey Alter on the XMRV confirmation paper. After Shixing Lo's talk, during what was supposed to be the question and answer session, Mikovits saw Quanti Zhang, the editor of the journal Retrovirology, stand up with some other researchers and start shouting, "Stop this waste of money! Stop this research now! We should be spending these resources on people with real viruses and real diseases." As the chair of the session, Silverman tried to calm the crowd, but they didn't appear to be mollified. Mikovits had never seen any behavior like it in the course of her 30 years in science, even though these gatherings had grown increasingly dramatic. Although the outburst had come after Lowe's talk, it was clearly aimed at Frank Rossetti and Judy Mikovits, who were seen as the investigators who started this research. Counterattackers were trying to shout them down with as much subtlety as an unruly mob. Wasn't this supposed to be science? The title of Frank Rossetti's presentation was Development of XMRV Producing B-Cell Lines from Lymphomas from Patients with Chronic Fatigue Syndrome. Rossetti presented the details behind the virus infection of B cells and the increased rate of certain types of cancers among the patients with ME/CFS, the issue, B cells, that had first drawn Mikovits to study the disease. The meeting abstract gave a condensed account of Rossetti's presentation at the Leuven conference. Rossetti noted that the incidence of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in the general U.S. population was 0.02%, but was nearly 5% of the ME/CFS patients. This translated into a long-time ME/CFS patient being 250 times more likely to come down with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma than a typical healthy person, an astronomical figure. He then observed that, additionally, development of cancer coincides with an outgrowth of gamma-delta T cells with specific clonal T-cell receptor gamma. We hypothesized that infection with XMRV and or other viruses can trigger a dysregulated immune response which favors the development of B-cell lymphoma. Accompanying the non-Hodgkin's lymphoma was an abnormal population of gamma-delta T-cells, an important component of the immune system. These data led Rossetti and Mikovits to suggest that infection with XMRV, either alone or in combination with other co-infections, such as those commonly found in ME/CFS patients, just as with HIV/AIDS patients, might trigger an abnormal immune response that was favorable to the development of this type of cancer. Rossetti detailed the numbers of ME/CFS patients with these rare types of cancer, their lab results, then concluded, "Therefore, XMRV infection may accelerate the development of B-cell malignancies by either chronic stimulation of the immune system and/or by direct infection of the B-cell lineage. Since viral load in peripheral blood is low, these data suggest that B cells in tissues such as spleen and lymph nodes could be an in vivo reservoir for XMRV." Rossetti's presentation covered several key points. The 11 ME/CFS patients with lymphomas or associated disorders all tested positive for XMRV, and 9 of the 11 were positive for the T cell rearrangements, which seemed to be a key indicator of a poorly functioning immune system. 4 B-cell lines from patients began spontaneously producing XMRV virus. One of the arguments against XMRV as a disease-causing pathogen was that even if the virus was able to infect humans, the human immune system would be able to tamp it down and control it. Specifically, the researchers argued that APOBEC3G, an antiviral enzyme, would fight off any such retrovirus. Rossetti and Mikovits found that the virus was replicating in these patients even though APOBEC3G was present. The researchers who opposed further investigation of XMRV and neuroimmune disorders presented various objections, but all these lacked an explanation as to why people with ME/CFS had a rate of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma 250 times greater than the regular population. A retroviral hypothesis fit the presentation of ME/CFS, and retroviruses had twice before been associated with ME/CFS. Although Mikovits was aware of how heated scientific controversies can become, it was in Leuven she saw the first evidence of the angry mob of scientists that Coffin would say a few months later in the journal Science would burn her at the stake. Mikovits could not forget the behavior of the chief editor of Retrovirology, Quanti Zhang. Why was the anger directed only at XMRV in ME/CFS and not in prostate cancer? Was it because Mikovits had suggested this retrovirus might be linked to other diseases besides ME/CFS, like autism? Was it because Mikovits was raising the possibility that there might be other, as yet unidentified, retroviruses associated with neurological conditions, such as autism and even cancers, which were rising at dramatic rates? Was that so horrible a possibility that a scientist testing viable hypotheses deserved to be burned at the stake? And though Mikovits was worn down by the controversy, first over suspected mouse DNA contamination, then Coffin's hybrid virus, and soon enough over the Silverman plasmid contamination, she knew there were many dramatic and pressing questions raised, and that she had to persevere. It was during one of the breaks between the sessions that Silverman approached Rossetti and said to him that Dasgupta really felt bad about what happened. Rossetti was confused. What did Dasgupta have to feel bad about? Silverman told Rossetti that some of the positive samples from WPI sequenced in his lab were contaminated by sequences present in the Silverman XMRV plasmid. If plasmid contamination was suspected, the controls he had told them he had done in the beginning should have shown plasmid contamination 2 years ago. Silverman had just given a talk in which he strongly supported the idea that XMRV was an actual human infection. Was he now suddenly bailing on ME/CFS and XMRV? There had been multiple lines of evidence of a system-wide immune dysfunction, and a retrovirus was still a viable hypothesis. Silverman had been at their side, defending their research against the negative studies, and even refusing calls to retract their publication in Science. But all that was about to change. In an attempt to distance himself from the MECFS and XMRV controversy, Silverman was planning to give his collaborators little time to determine whether his XMRV plasmid theory of contamination was valid. In an email Silverman sent at 5:59 p.m. on July 6, 2011 to his co-authors, he attached the data showing contamination in his lab and asked them to let him know in the next 2 days if they had any comments or whether they believed different actions should be taken. All of the co-authors were both shocked and disturbed by this email. He was now giving them a 2-day window to respond to his discovery of plasmid contamination before presenting it to Science and exposing what could be a disastrous scenario before they could offer any defense. This was not standard protocol. Frank Rossetti composed a reply to Silverman and sent it at 8:01 a.m. on the following morning, July 7, 2011. Dear Bob and co-authors, I find this study incomplete. In the interest of getting the scientific truth out before it is submitted, one should do the complete science and figure out the source of the contamination. It would seem appropriate that the Silverman lab do an equal number of XMRV positive DNA samples made from prostate cancer samples at roughly the same time as the CFS samples for CMV and NEO primers. I also think the Silverman lab should test the DNA made from the same patient samples, same time and WPI processing, made at the NCI from Mike Dean. Our labs have some of the same DNA, but those from the Dean lab would be a less contentious set of DNA to use. Let me know your thoughts. Regards, Frank. But Silverman did not seem interested in discovering the source of contamination, only in putting the XMRV in MECFS investigation behind him. He wrote back later that day, saying that while the source of the contamination interested them, it would not change the fact that Figure 1 of the Science article was wrong. He also stated that they might never know the source of the contamination, an assertion that Rossetti and Mikovits found to display an astonishing lack of scientific curiosity. How could Silverman not be concerned with finding the source of the contamination and how it might have affected their research? What infuriated Rossetti and Mikovits more than anything was the material he was planning to submit to Science. The letter implied that the contamination had taken place at Mikovits's lab at the WPI. On the one hand, he was saying in his email to them that they might never figure out the source of the contamination. He was clearly saying where he believed it had taken place in what he was sending to Science. Rossetti wrote him back a strongly worded email on July 7th, leaving little doubt as to his opinion. Dear Bob, I find your answer disingenuous to say the least. The source of contamination is of interest to us, but having that answer will not change the fact that Figure 1 is erroneous. Depending on the source of contamination, it will determine whether all the figures or just Figure 1 is discredited. All statements in this field about contamination pinpoint the problem. Science demands that we do so also. We may never figure out the source of the contamination, but we need to make public that the interpretation of Figure 1 is just plain wrong. The reality is, since the publication of the paper in 2009, nobody has believed Figure 1 is correct, so why the rush to publish before doing the experiments we suggest? Second, we all suspect, you may already know, thus the comment you said to me in Belgium that Jay feels awful about it, the source of contamination is your lab. These facts should be either experimentally tested or written in your letter, or we will send to Science in a letter from the other authors these facts. Rossetti then listed a number of ways that they might test the samples which had been relied upon in the Science article, and brought up what he believed were accusations that contamination had taken place at either the Whittemore Peterson Institute or the National Cancer Institute. Rossetti finished off the email. You protest too much. All this will be seen as an attempt to say that the contamination could not have occurred in the Silverman lab. The CFS and Healthy Control PBMC DNA samples were treated identically. Then why did you insist that the samples not be blinded? Why did you coerce Lombardi into culturing more patient samples without our permission or knowledge? These were the identical PBMC DNA samples in the original tubes that were used to produce Figure 1 of Lombardi et al., Science, 2009. I plead with you to do the experiments I suggested. What difference is another month? If your lab is as pure as Caesar's wife as you suggest, then you have nothing to worry about. Regards, Frank. Rossetti was laying out what seemed to him to be a logical, well-reasoned argument for a careful process, not just for the scientific community at large, but for the patients who had waited decades for answers. Silverman relented and delayed submission. Rossetti got DNA from 29 of the 30 samples, including the 11 samples published in Figure 1, and split them for plasmid detection in WPI and an independent lab. None of the samples showed evidence of plasmid contamination. Rossetti told this to Silverman in late July 2011. Neither Mikovits nor Rossetti ever heard from Silverman again. Silverman submitted his partial retraction to Science in August. Mikovits and Rossetti belatedly came to see what they believed was the bigger picture. They concluded that Silverman had been having lengthy discussions with John Coffin, who was trying to convince Silverman that his viral discovery had been an artifact, an account which would be backed up by Hillary Johnson's article in Discover magazine in March of 2013. At Coffin's urging, Silverman had investigated and found plasmid contamination with XMRV in some of his samples and wanted to retract his contribution to the original Science paper. Rossetti suggested they test other sets of samples for XMRV plasmid contamination, using the identical samples from the NCI and the WPI. Silverman responded with what seemed like evasions, noting that while the source was of interest to him, it still wouldn't change the fact that Figure 1 was inaccurate. There was little arguing with this point. However, Silverman continued to say, "We may never figure out the source of the contamination," which, while superficially true, begs the question of how does one know until you performed the experiment? Error analysis in Science is supposed to be just as rigorous as the preceding experiments. Mikovits and her collaborators still fully believed in their evidence regarding an association between an XMRV-like retrovirus and ME/CFS, despite what Silverman had suggested. They had been rigorous in sorting out the issue already. There were the positive results from the spleen focus-forming virus antibody test, their own GAG sequences, partial ENV sequences, GAG and ENV protein, protein detection in unmanipulated plasma, and even the electron micrograph pictures of the virus budding from the cellular membrane of patient cells. Still, they worked to determine whether there was any validity to Silverman's claim of XMRV plasmid contamination. On or about July 8, 2011, Dr. Mikovits called into her office Hagen, Post, and Lombardi, who worked on Project X, and asked them all to bring their notebooks. Lombardi brought in 4 Xeroxed pages from his notebook. "This is it?" Mikovits asked. "This is all the work you've ever done in the research lab." She was aghast at his paltry contribution, standing there next to the other associates with their rigorously detailed work. Lombardi answered in the affirmative, saying that the rest of his notebooks were proprietary information, which belonged to the for-profit clinical company, VIPDX. Mikovits made a mental note to revise his level of effort in the R01 annual progress report she had recently filed with Carly West Kinney. Mikovits took the pages from Lombardi and put them aside. Her only concern was trying to determine if any possibility of contamination existed in their earlier work. In her review of Katie Hagen's notebook, Mikovits found a peculiar entry for March 23, 2009. Katie kept a meticulous lab book, but her handwriting was often difficult to read. Mikovits could make out that on March 23, 2009, Lombardi had directed Hagen to culture the identical 30 samples that WPI had sent to Silverman twice before, so the Silverman lab could do single-round PCR, which he wanted for Figure 1 in the manuscript. Apparently, after Mikovits told Silverman they were not going to send the samples again because neither lab could get positive results from single-round PCR, Silverman had asked Lombardi to send them. Mikovits asked Katie if one of the entries said XMRV positive, plus sign, or XMRV negative, minus sign. Katie looked at the entry in the lab book. That's XMRV positive. Mikovits felt like she might have a stroke. Culturing infected cells with patient cells would not result in plasmid contamination, but could have resulted in infection of those cells through aerosolization, as Gasder's lab had just discovered. She recalled how on January 24, 2009, a few days after signing the collaboration agreement with Rossetti and Silverman, she'd emailed the HIV decontamination protocols to Katie as soon as she could. Katie even taped the protocols in her lab book. The critical thing to do for the integrity of the work was to prevent against the possibility of contamination. Mikovits immediately called a meeting with Harvey to explain what she'd uncovered, including the 4 pages of work in the research lab for which Lombardi had been paid for 50% effort. Harvey asked why she thought Lombardi had violated the protocols. In an email to Harvey, she cited Lombardi's arrogance and refusal to take direction from a woman. Asked why she thought he'd hidden it for 2 years? He was a coward. Mikovits was furious. Annette's reaction to the latest Silverman controversy was immediately protective of their fiduciary interests. The Whittemores were making a presentation to a major diagnostic company, which had given WPI $150,000 per month since October 2010 for the intellectual property rights to the serology test. Annette sent Judy an email directing her to make sure that Silverman plasmid contamination theory did not get out until they could make their presentation to the company July 24, 2011, so that the next financial installments could come in. Cultured virus is not plasmid contamination, so now they had 2 sources of potential contamination to track down. An idea Mikovits had been considering from the very start of the research was that the disease-causing potential of XMRV might be related to the body's reaction to proteins on the envelope of the virus. There existed all sorts of variations on this idea, with one notion that some were defective viruses expressing some proteins, but not what is known as a replication-competent virus. For a virus to be infectious and transmissible, it must be replication-competent. If a virion consisted mainly of an envelope with defective genetic sequences inside, most scientists will consider the organism to be of little concern to human health. Mikovits's postdoctoral work had shown defective HTLV-1 virions could still express pathogenic proteins. Another group of scientists, Sandy Rossetti among them, have spent their careers trying to determine whether proteins in the envelope of the virus might be causing an abnormal immune system response and inducing autoimmune disorders. The process is similar to an allergic reaction. A peanut is not inherently dangerous. Most people can eat a peanut butter and jelly sandwich with a smile and a satisfied belly. But in some, the body mistakenly identifies peanuts as dangerous, floods the system with antibodies, and causes lethal reactions, including anaphylaxis and death. Some believed it was likely that in some cases, the envelope of a virus might be causing an autoimmune reaction in which the body was attacking certain types of cells, leading to diseases like cancer and even neurological conditions. In a sense, this was a solution that would allow both camps to be right. Coffin and others could proclaim that XMRV Silverman, or whatever closely related retrovirus might eventually be linked to ME/CFS and other conditions, was not an infectious exogenous virus as the term is generally understood. Mikovits and Rossetti could say in turn that an XMRV-like retrovirus was linked to conditions like ME/CFS and possibly autism, but the mechanism of action for damage was not a classic infection per se, but the body's autoimmune response to proteins of a poorly infectious defective virus. This approach could open up many intriguing avenues of investigation. If the envelope of the virus acted as an autoantigen, the question would turn to the immune response of the individual. Just as many people could eat peanuts without suffering harm, perhaps the majority of the population could harbor this virus without any ill effects. In the case of autism, maybe infants could be tested for the presence of the virus, and then if they tested positive, a different vaccination schedule would be provided, just as was done for HIV-positive children. Perhaps by simple monitoring of the immune functions of a child, one could track whether the vaccination was likely to cause an autoimmune response. This was not such a radical idea, just often happening on scientific islands outside of the Mikovits team. Even study into the long-term progression of treated AIDS, that is, those patients on antiretroviral therapy to control the HIV virus, found that due to the now longer lifespans of treated AIDS patients, inflammation and autoimmune-like reactions were major players in ongoing symptomatology and even accelerated aging. As reported by AIDS journalist Liz Heiliman, untreated HIV infection causes inflammation, and despite ART, it does not normalize, Stephen Deeks, professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, UCSF, explained at a post-CROI workshop sponsored by Project Inform. This leads to all sorts of badness. Some 20 presentations showed this same phenomenon linking HIV, inflammatory biomarkers, age-related symptoms, and immunosenescence, accelerated aging of the immune system. So even in more accepted retrovirology, as Heiliman continued, the end result of classic autoimmunity and the inflammation from a persistent or controlled infection could lead to similar end results. This fine-tuned system of the immune system clearing problems and then turning itself down can go awry, however, when the immune system is faced with a threat it cannot overcome. This occurs, for example, during persistent infection. Other causes of chronic inflammation include autoimmune conditions, in which the immune system attacks the body's own tissues, obesity, chronic stress, and exposure to toxins such as tobacco smoke. But first, before diverging into questions about envelope material and allergic or inflammatory responses, everyone wanted to know whether Silverman's XMRV plasmid had contaminated the data in the 2009 Science paper linking XMRV with ME/CFS. It was an important question, and nobody wanted the answer more than Mikovits. Mikovits, Rossetti, and Post would spend the summer of 2011 trying to answer that question. Unfortunately, she had to direct most of her attention to the blood working group. The WPI and NCI focused the month of July on completing the BWG panel due July 31st, and Judy Mikovits asked Frank Rossetti to sit on the WPI staff meetings. There had developed a great deal of tension for Mikovits as Harvey Whittemore insisted on running Mikovits's lab meetings. The Whittemores were unhappy about the negative data from Mikovits and Rossetti when the BSRI decoded the samples. Lombardi would never say anything and would never bring any raw data to evaluate until the last meeting before the deadline, August 1st. When they saw the data, Mikovits and Rossetti were stunned beyond belief. In a written recollection, Rossetti stated, "The data presented by Vinny for us to send to the BWG as a serology test was the worst data I have ever seen presented as a finished product. Immunoblots with no molecular weight markers, most have background, which makes identifying the bands difficult if not impossible. The positive bands were marked with arrows, which was good because without the arrows they were indistinguishable. The positive bands were only guesses. Every scientist to whom I showed it only laughed. Furthermore, despite the fact that VIPDX was charging patients for the culture method and reporting positives to patients, Lombardi had failed to produce any usable culture data. It brought in focus ever more clearly the problems with the clinical lab." Annette Whittemore responded to these concerns by writing in an email to Mikovits, copying Rossetti, "This complete and utter failure of the BWG was no one's fault but yours, and blaming the clinical lab for your poor decision-making is unacceptable." In a separate email written that same day, Annette thanked Rossetti for his help, but did not blame him for making the same decision. Rossetti goes on to say that Annette then ordered Judy to submit the clinical data to the BWG, which Mikovits refused to do. When the head of the blood working group, Dr. Michael Bush, came to the WPI and toured the clinical lab a few weeks later, Rossetti says he sent an email which stated, "I was underimpressed by Vinny, to say the least, and what I saw and understood in terms of validation and QC, quality control, of the assays in the clinical lab was disturbing." On September 23, 2011, Mikovits presented her findings at the International Association for ME/CFS, which was held in Ottawa, Canada. The session was chaired by Dr. Jose Montoya of Stanford University, who also presented his work on the role of the immune response in CFS. Mikovits then presented the case for human gamma retroviruses, XMRV, HGRV, in ME/CFS, while John Coffin presented the case against XMRV. As the issue of XMRV was becoming problematic, Mikovits was now referring to the possible pathogen by a more generic name, a human gamma retrovirus, since data still suggested she was seeing evidence of a gamma retrovirus in patients. She started her presentation by showing an electron micrograph of a human gamma retrovirus budding from the cell of an ME/CFS patient. The showing of a similar electron micrograph by Luc Montagnier had convinced the world that HIV retrovirus existed. She even had the same microscopist that Montagnier had used taking the picture. Despite being depicted as some kind of renegade scientist, her work was both by the book of classic science and in the footsteps of a giant HIV predecessor, because she wanted to get it right. The next slide showed the direct isolation of XMRV-HGRV protein from the plasma of ME/CFS patients. This was the test in which they used the antibodies almost like magnets to draw out the proteins from the plasma. and those proteins could only be created in an actual living organism. If they weren't in the blood at the time it was drawn, no contamination could explain that level of protein. Next, she showed that these retroviruses could infect another cell line, a key test of whether a virus might be pathogenic. Taking Silverman's latest theory head-on, she had a schematic of the circular DNA of the XMRV-containing VP62 plasmid, showing the various markers that would allow them to detect it in any of their samples. Mikovits was fond of saying that virology is not rocket science, and often thought the field was more akin to the type of knowledge a good car mechanic had. If one suspects contamination with a certain agent, in this case Silverman's XMRV VP62 plasmid, one knows it has certain genetic markers that will allow a scientist to identify it as a man-made creation. After knowing those characteristics, one can test for them. If they are present, one has contamination. If they aren't, there's no contamination. It's like taking your car to a mechanic and testing to see if the brake pads are still good. Mikovits showed that in Figure 1 of the original science paper that was prepared by Silverman of the Cleveland Clinic, some samples did contain the VP62 plasmid. However, the original DNA samples, which were housed at the WPI, were tested by Max Post and Frank Rossetti, were free of the VP62 plasmid. An independent reanalysis of the same samples also showed the samples to be free of the plasmid or other mouse contamination, the previous theory Coffin had held against XMRV. There was no crap, mouse or otherwise, in their argument. The next slide showed the cell-free transmission of XMRV to LNCAP cells. The following slide showed results from a single patient, demonstrating that they appeared to have two separate strains of a human gamma retrovirus, a result often found with other human retroviruses. The next few slides contained information about the results of the blood working group, which Mikovits had been working with since shortly after the original science paper was published. The report was to be published during the Ottawa conference, as well as the article False Positive in Science. All of this negative press was slated to be published on the same day as her talk at the Ottawa conference. She wondered ruefully which story would get the greater coverage, the article in Science, the results from the blood working group, or her explanation of the latest findings. She'd never been much of a believer in the idea that public perception on certain vital issues was manipulated by powerful forces, but in this instance, she felt increasingly that only one side of the debate was being presented. The blood working group had been created with a single goal in mind, to determine whether XMRV posed a threat to the blood supply. It had become something else, a stalking horse for the association of XMRV with ME/CFS. Specifically, the blood working group had been using Silverman's VP62 clone as the control for finding the virus in individuals. As far as anybody could tell, Silverman's VP62 clone was different enough in its sequence to the sequences Lowe and Alter were detecting. After their paper was published, they became members of the blood working group. And while the blood working group had been finding evidence of XMRV-like gag and pull sequences in some patients, they tightened the standards for calling a sample positive by saying there had to be both gag and pull sequences in the sample in order to call it positive. Silverman's infectious molecular clone was useful for doing animal studies to determine what might happen to the immune system of the infected animals. The Emory study showed that viral and proviral signals from Silverman XMRV disappeared from the blood within a month, but remained in the tissues, where they could be reactivated by immune stimulation, such as happens when one gets a vaccination. In most of the emery animals, the testing showed that the antibody responses were generally low in magnitude and short in duration. Would this explain the lack of positivity in the blood? When extrapolated to the human population, it made detection problematic. Mikovits next went on to the test, which she believed to be the most reliable in detecting this still elusive pathogen, or whatever degraded virus might be causing an immune reaction. She fell back again on the assay used to detect antibodies to the envelope of the spleen focus-forming virus, which had proven the most reliable evidence of XMRV-HGRV detection. In her next slide, she showed the antibodies they had detected in human samples reacting to multiple proteins of XMRV, including P12, P15, MA/E, RecEnv, P30, and GP70. She also showed how the gold standard of molecular virology, the Western blot method, could also detect the GP70 and P30 proteins in this population. Mikovits was careful to note on the slide that the ability to recognize XMRV proteins does not mean that XMRV was the immunogen. It could be any HGRV, human gamma retrovirus, or a cross-reactive protein. Still, the data was showing that something was generating these aberrant proteins. Her answer to the problems of detection was the use of next-generation sequencing, and she showed the results of some of that research she'd conducted in collaboration with the company Hemisphyrx Biopharma. The next-generation sequencing had detected XMRV-HGRV in 7 of 8 ME/CFS patients, and in only 2 out of 17 controls. Her conclusion was that the next-generation sequencing offered a solution to the problems of the detection of these viral proteins. For future plans regarding next-generation sequencing, she suggested increasing the sequencing coverage for each DNA sample, using appropriate age, sex, and geographical matched non-ME/CFS controls, and looking at more than the 75 base pairs already identified. This would enable them to investigate viral human chimeras, which would show the integration of the virus into human DNA. Mikovits showed the research Frank Rossetti had presented in Leuven, Belgium, specifically how 3 B-cell lines from patients who tested positive for XMRV had spontaneously immortalized, a precursor of cancer. The takeaway message for a patient with ME/CFS was basically a very disheartening, "life sucks and then you die." In her summary, Mikovits made the following points. 1. We have shown that we can detect HGRV-XMRV footprints in the blood by serology and nucleic acid analysis without any evidence of contamination. 2. Some CFS plasma contains HGRV-XMRV proteins and antibodies that recognize XMRV-HGRV viral antigens. 3. XMRV-producing hematopoietic cell lines, B and NK-like, were developed from CFS patients. 4. XMRV-HGRV-infected individuals exhibit cytokine profiles characteristic of inflammatory processes. 5. Sequence data indicate there are different strains of XMRV-HGRVs that can infect humans. In the conclusions section, she wrote, "The pathogenic potential of HGRVs in ME/CFS deserves further exploration." During the question and answer session, she'd been asked about the XMRV test being sold by the clinical lab founded by the Whittemores, VIPDX. The VIPDX test had been used by the blood working group. The VIPDX test had used Silverman's XMRV VP62 infectious molecular clone as the control. She answered the question the only way she knew how, by telling what she thought. Mikovits said that given the results of the blood working group, The VIPDX test could no longer in good conscience be used. Prior to the Ottawa conference, Mikovits knew that more than 3,000 people had been tested at VIPDX, and that the cost for the various tests ranged from approximately $500 to $700, making it somewhere between $1.5 million and a little over $2 million that the test had thus far generated. Mikovits might have been overstepping her boundaries in answering the question. She was head of the research lab, not the clinical lab. In the end, all a scientist has is his or her integrity, and she didn't want anybody to ever believe she would shade the truth, regardless of whom it might offend. They had asked her opinion, and she had given it, without regard for the consequences. That was the duty of a scientist. And now began what Mikovits considered to be the wholesale abandonment of the patients. The medical community did not want to look at the question of whether mouse retroviruses, probably of the type which had contaminated research labs for decades, had somehow jumped into the human population. Once again, scientists turned their backs on ME/CFS patients, like a herd of skittish deer. The release of the findings from the blood working group on the day of Mikovits's talk at the Ottawa conference was part of the strategy. It was curious how the mission of the blood working group had morphed from the question of whether XMRV posed a danger to the blood supply to whether XMRV was associated with ME/CFS. Also released on the day of Mikovits's talk, September 23, 2011, was an article in Science entitled False Positive, by John Cohen and Martin Ensorink. The article noted the original findings published 2 years earlier in Science linking a gamma retrovirus to CFS, and that questions had been raised. And leading the charge was the man she had tried her entire professional life to avoid. In the article, Gallo is quoted as saying, "Once claims of etiology were made, I just gasped for breath. My own experience argued to me that it's best to stay away from this one." For somebody attempting to figure out the investigative approach of the public health authorities, the real question did not seem to be whether scientists had found a promising lead into what was causing ME/CFS, but whether they were defending XMRV as if the retrovirus was the wealthy defendant in a high-profile murder trial. Discussing the Low and Alter study, the Science article by Cohen and Ensorink mentioned how many previous efforts at discovering what lay behind ME/CFS had failed to pan out, suggesting that this was just one more such regrettable failure. And of course they had to include Coffin's remark comparing Mikovits to Joan of Arc, and that the scientists will burn her at the stake, but her faithful following will have her canonized. Cohen and Ensorink gave the final words in this section of the article to Mikovits, noting that she viewed the Low and Alter paper as confirming her work, and that from the beginning, she viewed XMRV as one of many gamma retroviruses, which includes the MLVs involved with CFS. In the Lombardi study, some patients tested negative in PCR tests for XMRV and yet produced MLV-related proteins, she claimed, but they decided to count them as negatives. She has another serious regret about the paper. "I'd not put XMRV into the title," Mikovits says. "We never considered it would be a single sequence." The number from the healthy controls in the Mikovits study meant that more than 10 million Americans were infected with a mouse leukemia-related retrovirus. Then along came Low and Alter, who found another mouse leukemia retrovirus present in 86.5% of ME/CFS patients and 6.8% of healthy controls. The 6.8% number in the Low and Alter study translated to more than 21 million citizens in the United States infected with a mouse-related leukemia retrovirus. With somewhere between 10 and 21 million Americans infected with a mouse-related leukemia retrovirus whether or not linked to a debilitating condition like ME/CFS and possibly other neuroimmune diseases like autism, it didn't appear that anybody was raising an alarm. Why? Has it become bad form in science to ask inconvenient questions? A few days later, after she left the lab on September 29, 2011, Mikovits learned that Lombardi, who worked at the clinical lab and not in her research lab, was claiming that a cell line purchased with WPI grant money belonged to him. Mikovits knew it was also the end of the government fiscal year, and Lombardi had not done any work on the grant, and had stated as much to Carly West Kinney and Annette and Harvey in mid-July. If he had not done any work during the reporting period, it would be a federal crime to claim part of his salary for the grant. In the past few months, Mikovits had scientifically defended the XMRV ME/CFS research against claims of mouse contamination, Coffin's hybrid virus, which could only have been created after the appearance of ME/CFS, Silverman's infectious molecular clone, VP62, which had contaminated samples, plasmid contamination, and then she'd told her employers that they couldn't submit their clinical lab's data to the blood working group because it was substandard, and that they had to stop selling their potentially lucrative XMRV blood test. It's probably not surprising, given this chain of events and the stress everybody was under, that when Mikovits answered her cell phone as she walked home after work that day, that it was Annette Whittemore telling Mikovits she had been fired for insolence. It seems it's rude to refuse a direct order to commit a federal crime, thought Mikovits. Mikovits and Annette Whittemore had experienced their share of disagreements in the past and had been able to resolve them. Mikovits expected they would be able to sort out all their problems in the next few days. She was very wrong.